Hey, this is just a quick note about our sponsor, Privado, the premier enterprise privacy platform, purpose-built to bridge the gap between privacy and engineering. Its privacy code scanning solution embeds privacy, compliance, and governance into the product development lifecycle and empowers privacy and security teams with unparalleled visibility of sensitive data flows and the insights to find and fix privacy vulnerabilities. You can leverage Privado's data flows, dynamic data mapping, privacy assessment automation, and real-time visibility of privacy issues. Enter the era of proactive privacy and transform privacy from business blocker to business enabler. To learn more, go to privado.ai. Hello, I am Deborah J. Farber. Welcome to the Shifting Privacy Left podcast, where we talk about embedding privacy by design and default into the engineering function to prevent privacy harms to humans and to prevent dystopia. Each week, we'll bring you unique discussions with global privacy technologists and innovators working at the bleeding edge of privacy research and emerging technologies, standards, business models, and ecosystems. Welcome, everyone, to Shifting Privacy Left. I'm your host and resident privacy guru, Deborah J. Farber. Today, I'm delighted to welcome my next guest, Melanie Ensign, founder and CEO of Discernible. After managing security and privacy communications for some of the world's most notable brands, including Facebook, Uber, and AT&T, Melanie founded Discernible to help even more organizations adopt effective communication strategies to improve risk-related outcomes. She counsels executives and technical teams alike to cut through internal politics, dysfunctional inertia, and meaningless metrics. I love that. For the past 10 years, Melanie has also led the press department and communication strategy for DEF CON, the world's largest hacker community. She's an accomplished scuba diver and brings many lessons learned preventing, preparing for, and navigating unexpected high-risk underwater incidents to her work in security and privacy. I'm also lucky to call Melanie a really close friend and collaborator. So I'm super pumped for our discussion today to focus on the importance of communication strategies and tactics for privacy engineering and technical teams. Welcome, Melanie. So good to have you
here. Oh, Deb, thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
Awesome. Awesome. So just to kick things off, it makes sense, I think, to ask you to give us an overview as to how did you get into security and privacy communications? I know you didn't start out that way.
No, actually, a little bit by accident. In fact, I started my undergraduate education in marine biology. I grew up with the ambition of becoming a shark scientist. And truthfully, if I had to do it again, I wish somebody would have told me to pick a major based on what I wanted to do as a job versus the subject matter that I wanted to know the most about. Because I loved learning about sharks, but I decided ultimately it was not the right career path for me. And I ended up graduating with a degree in communications. And then I went to graduate school and got my master's of science in corporate public relations. And from there, I parlayed my previous scientific acumen and literacy into helping companies translate very technical and scientific concepts into things that other audiences and non-experts could understand. So worked on a number of tech companies in terms of some of their sustainability efforts and environmental impact projects. And ultimately, at this time, I was working at a large global public relations agency. And I sat down with my manager at the time and said, look, one of the reasons why I chose this firm was because we have 80 offices all over the world. And I really wanted some international experience. And right now, I'm only working with two of those offices. So I asked for an international global project. And I said, if I need to learn something new, I'm willing to do that. But I would like something that could help me grow and really stretch my global experience. And so the opportunity that was presented to me pretty early on in my career was leading security communications for AT&T. And this included not just their MSSP business, which was their managed security B2B business, but also for their internal corporate security team. At the time, both of those organizations were led by the chief security officer. So you know, the chief security officer was responsible even for the business and consulting side of security at the company. And I did not know anything about cybersecurity at the time. I had a little bit of kind of like a early entry into the world of programming when I was very young. My dad taught me how to code in DOS, which was a short-lived skill. But, you know, when I discovered this world of cybersecurity, it pushed some buttons and filled some gaps for me in terms of personal satisfaction that I didn't realize I was missing previously. And it gave me an opportunity to, we weren't just selling something, we weren't just managing an organization's reputation, but there was a really net positive cause behind the whole thing in terms of helping keep people safe, respecting their data. So it naturally fit with me. And for the next 6 years, I just got so immersed in the world of cybersecurity and eventually privacy when I moved on to some other organizations. But I found that the people in this space were so wonderful because they were doing something to make things better for others. And so unlike some of, you know, my colleagues in communications or marketing or public relations, where they get really excited about the attention that they can get through that work, what really fuels me and what really got me to commit to this particular subject matter was that at the end of the day, we were making a positive impact on the world. We weren't just developing new tech for the sake of new tech, right? And we were helping people to protect themselves and to get a better understanding and higher level of literacy about what was happening with their data and their experiences online and with technology. So it was almost by accident that I stumbled into this space. But as soon as I found it, it was kind of love at first sight. I found it very fulfilling. And I found the technical elements of it to be interesting. And those elements are changing so quickly that it keeps my interest on a pretty consistent basis.
That makes sense to me. I mean, you know, you're also talking to somebody who's an English major and went to law school, did lots of writing. So communicating, even though it's a different type of communicating for legal, right? A different audience, different way of communicating. I had the same kind of pull to the space of privacy and security of that. It's constantly changing. It's constantly changing and I'm never going to get bored, right? So yeah. It kind of pulls you in. And if you like that kind of constant change, or that change is the only constant kind of mentality, then, you know, this area is for you, right?
Yeah. I mean, honestly, I entered the space of time back when just the term hacker was considered so negative, right? Like white hats and pen testers technically are hackers, but it was such an unfamiliar term to most of the world that for me, I just saw this immediate connection between what I had been doing in trying to educate the public and policymakers for better shark conservation policies and better environmental protections. Immediately saw the connection between that and the need to educate people on what a hacker really is and why it's important that we have both sharks and hackers in our world in order to maintain healthy environments, right? Whether that's a marine world where we need these apex predators. One of the first signs that a reef is unhealthy is when the sharks disappear, right? And same thing with our digital lives, where if we don't protect, you know, the hackers that are helping to make things better, we lose it, like a really important part of kind of like our immune system, right? In our digital lives. So there was a really obvious application from my perspective in terms of things that I had been doing in shark science, in helping people kind of get over their initial fear of the unknown and being able to apply that in the security space as well.
I love the comparison. And I know that you've spoken in the past, particularly with a keynote speech on shark science and applying how people think about the fear of sharks, even when they don't necessarily, it doesn't make sense to even have that fear based on the reality and how that psychological, you know, way of thinking, or that your brain can get into that psychological state of fear with security breaches or being afraid to do things. And you make some connections there. And I just love that overlap with these disparate or seemingly disparate areas of marine biology, shark science, and privacy and security. It's just, I love it.
You know, there are so few new ideas in the world, to be honest. And like, this is something that actually comes up a lot in my work, even with privacy engineers, is there are so few new ideas that humans have been really good about documenting a lot of the things that we have learned, you know, over the past thousands of years. And a lot of times when we think we have discovered a new idea, what we're actually doing is identifying knowledge and ideas that exist in a different discipline that have yet to be applied in our own. And so, you know, whether I'm working with CISOs or chief privacy officers or privacy engineers, and they're like, all of a sudden, there's this movement and eagerness towards building trust, right? Where we know a lot of things about trust, actually. We have thousands and thousands of years of research and a body of knowledge about how trust is built, how it's maintained, how you nurture it, how you continue that. And so it is thrilling to see, you know, the privacy world really take this on as a value proposition for their profession. But we don't need to be recreating the wheel, right? Privacy does not need to define what trust is or how it's earned and how you maintain those relationships. There is tons and tons of scholarship from the field of communications that already exists in how this works. And so, you know, that's one of the things that I'm constantly working on with our clients is where does this knowledge already exist? Right? Let's not like spin cycles unnecessarily. Let's go find knowledge that already exists and let's apply it to the problem that we're facing so that we can take advantage of the fact that somebody else has already learned these lessons and we're going to apply it into a new context.
That makes a lot of sense. In fact, I mean, we do that all the time with comparing privacy to the security space and how we're about, I don't know, 15 years behind security and, you know, lessons learned from other risk-related areas. So actually, I think this is a good segue to ask if you could give some insight into what like a comms professional like yourself does on a day-to-day basis to support technical teams like privacy engineers, and maybe pepper that with some examples of, you know, from your time at Uber and Facebook. Not that you have to be specific on projects or anything, but like...
Yeah, absolutely. So the work that I do and for folks that are in similar positions, I think of it in kind of two buckets, right? There's the work that we do for the privacy tech companies, right? Kind of like on the vendor side where we're advising on go-to-market communications, right? So once they've decided what they're building, where they fit in the market, you know, it's like, how do you explain that to other people, right? Which can help with investment. It can help with customers. It can help with partnerships and their internal teams as well, and helping them form kind of where they fit in that world, right? That can also include different types of coaching, public speaking, content development, helping them just be more effective communicators with the ultimate goal of helping them sell whatever the solution is that they've built. So that's one category. But the other half of our business, which I think is really applicable to your listeners, is the work that we do with internal privacy teams. So we do this for both security and privacy, but I'll focus on privacy engineering, given the scope of the podcast.
Thank you.
We are essentially like the one-stop shop for these internal teams who need counsel, advice, and guidance on what are the effective ways to communicate about privacy to our various stakeholders, right? So it could be anything in terms of working with the chief privacy officer on their upcoming presentation to the board, to advising on product or feature proposals that are going through the company and helping them think, how is this particular aspect of our product or our service going to be perceived externally, especially when we work so close on a project or a product that we care a lot about. It can be difficult to see around the corner and imagine that people would either misunderstand or interpret what we're doing in a different way than what our real intent is, right? But that happens all the time. I wrote a blog post a while ago, actually, about preventing privacy outrage, right? So there's a misconception, I think, within the world of privacy that privacy events always involve some kind of security breach, right? That once there's been a security incident, well, now we have to think about the fact that there are privacy implications for, you know, the exposure of that personal data. The reality is there are privacy incidents that happen all the time that are not getting the appropriate support from a communications perspective that they deserve. So things like, oh, I don't know, if you collect user phone numbers for the purposes of 2FA, and then you end up using it for targeted advertising. For some companies, that may result in a very, very negative and public news cycle. complete with congressional probes, regulatory audits. I consider that to be an incident, even if it didn't include a security breach, because of the resources and the time that is required to respond to that type of an event. And so we advise on how can we actually avoid those things to begin with, right? There is an unfortunate kind of norm within the world of corporate communications where we tend to get promoted in our profession when there is a crisis, right? That we are rewarded for how we have managed the crisis rather than being rewarded for how did we use our skills and influence to prevent the crisis. Right. So that's something that my team takes very seriously is, you know, when we're advising clients on what they're building or even something as simple as a blog post, I mean, there's a huge percentage of, you know, FTC consent orders that I have been involved in throughout my career that started with misleading statements on websites and blog posts, right? Not a security breach. So being able to work with companies on what are you saying publicly across all of these different channels, including, you know, I think many of us are amused by the story of Max Schramm's rise to influence actually originating with a big tech lawyer presentation to Max Schramm's class at Stanford when he was in law school. So even something as simple as where are your lawyers speaking outside of your company can have a huge impact later on for the company in terms of what are you saying publicly? You know, how are you going to be accountable for that? Is it accurate? Right? I don't believe that all of these companies are intentionally lying. I think some of them are, but I don't think that's most of them. It's just careless, and it is kind of a lack of visibility of what's around the corner, right? Because for the most part, they are used to working with communication teams that aren't advising proactively on how to avoid an incident from occurring, because those individuals get rewarded for walking through the fire once it happens, right? And right. We take a different approach where we just like when our clients have less fires. So whether it's advising on a blog post or a product idea or a conference talk, or even how do we communicate to our employees? How do we communicate to our board? We do a lot of training with engineering teams about how to negotiate shared outcomes with other engineering organizations, right? So being a privacy engineer, most of the time, I mean, privacy engineering is such a new concept in terms of specific domain knowledge, that most people that are doing privacy engineering right now are software engineers, back-end engineers, right? And they're trying to talk to the infrastructure team or the data platform team or the product development team. And even though they're all engineers, they are not all speaking the same language. So being able to help those teams communicate with each other can actually get, it kind of accelerates the process for privacy engineering within an organization, because it's like pass, go, collect $200 rather than having to constantly swim upstream.
That makes a lot of sense to me. It's kind of also part of that like shift left mentality, right? Instead of just dealing with the crisis, it's like, let's prevent the crises, right? Let's move a little further. Let's move further into the product development process to think about comms, but not afterwards, after something's built and like, now you're just going to go to market with it, or now you're going to publicly disclose something, right? So I love that. In fact, I want to read a pretty glowing endorsement of you written by Nishant Bajaria, the senior privacy engineering manager at Uber, actually just moved to Meta, but was just at Uber and was your former colleague. And he says, her knowledge of the InfoSec domain, grasp of the details, read of the room and command of how features play to the message, make her the rare breed, one that combines technical knowledge with organizational navigation. She never, ever, ever is obsessed with driving a story. Rather, she invested her political capital in building features that protected security and privacy. For her, trust was built on the bedrock of capability rather than the quicksand of spin. She held engineering and leadership at Uber to a high standard. She is like the training wheels on a bike. She will keep you from falling, but also equip you to go forth on your own. I mean, that's honestly, couldn't ask for a more glowing recommendation from anyone, and especially Nishant, who, you know, wrote the book on the run book, basically, for data privacy and for technologists to follow. And so I guess I want to ask you, what's the secret? How can companies use technical communication strategies and tactics to earn trust with the public and with your, obviously, with your stakeholders like Nishant here?
Yeah, I mean, I think the big thing, I hate to use this word authenticity, but like it's so core to being effective as a communicator. I remember when I was interviewing for my job at Uber, this particular interview that I was in happened to be with somebody who I knew from a previous job. So this is somebody that I had some history with. And, you know, I said, you know, I know it's been, you know, a little bit since we've worked together, but I want to remind you of who I am. I am not coming to Uber to put lipstick on a pig. So if you are hoping that I'm just going to magically make these external, you know, public perception problems go away, I am not the right person for this job. I am going to focus on making your organization what you aspire to be so that the PR job is just about creating the windows so people can see it. And I believe in that, not just because I think it is the only way for an honest communications professional to sleep at night, but because it's also, it gives your reputation strength and longevity. You do not get benefit of the doubt when you make a mistake. If you have a history of bottling everything up, being really obscure, and trying to spin every situation away from accountability. And again, this is, you know, I'll just loop back to what I was talking about earlier about there being this body of knowledge about trust and, you know, and all this scholarship from the field of communication. We know how hard it is to build a positive reputation for something and how quickly you can lose it. So those of us who profess to be communication experts should be the strongest champions for honesty and authenticity and helping our organizations become what they aspire to be makes the external communication part so much easier because it's honest and we're not burying bodies. I think that's one of the biggest lessons that I learned through my time in Silicon Valley is that buried bodies are not just stressful, but they're very expensive. And if you've got skeletons in your closet, the sooner you bring them out and teach them how to dance, the better off you're going to be as an organization.
Oh my God, what a visual. I love the visual. That's great.
I mean, if people are willing to give you a second chance when they feel that you deserve it, right? It gets a little bit tricky when we start talking about like 17th and 18th chances. But people need to genuinely see an effort to change. And I think that that's something that big tech is struggling with now is we now have 20, 30 years of history with these companies and not a whole lot has changed, particularly for their users, for regulators. And I think people are kind of at the point where it's like, look, you've had every opportunity to prove that you could do it on your own. You either can't or you really don't want to.
Yeah, which is why I'm generally skeptical of self-regulatory attempts, like what the advertising industry attempted to do and then, you know, fell asleep at the wheel.
I think there have to be the right incentives for, like, I think we're at the point now where I do see some new incentives from the market where, you know, we're starting to see, you know, particularly in advertising world, people scrambling to be like, oh, shoot, now there's a reason to self-regulate. But there hasn't been that pressure, at least coming from the right areas and at the right magnitude and intensity for these companies to change. And they're so focused on short-term results. And we can argue about whether or not they should be, right? I mean, even like, you know, the Business Roundtable years ago made the decision that shareholders should not be the number one priority for businesses. And yet it's still often run that way, right? And so I think we have to be honest about, are there the right incentives for self-regulation in all of these circumstances? You know, by and large, when it comes to big tech, I don't think that has been there in the privacy space. But I also think at the same time, it has been there longer than companies wanted to admit, right?
Absolutely.
Advertisers and marketers inside companies were benefiting off of these bullshit metrics that they were getting from Facebook, you know, in terms of elevating their own influence and position within their organizations, right? So when did we expect any advertiser on Facebook to tell their boss, like, hey, these metrics are mostly meaningless and it's violating people's privacy in the process, right? There's a whole industry built around marketers needing numbers to sit at a C-suite table.
Right.
And, you know, it just took way too long, I think, even for CEOs to look at their CMO and go, what do these numbers actually mean? Like, engagement is not a bottom line measurement.
Right. Which is kind of funny. It makes me think of Twitter and how Elon Musk is continually like, oh, Twitter's never been so alive. Look at all the engagement. And you're like, does that translate into advertising dollars? Like, are people actually, you know, there's fewer advertisers down there now and that's the problem. So like, who cares how many people are active? That is not necessarily going to translate into revenue generation. So tell me more about how the translation process and the conversion to maybe someone buying something, but just engaging alone, it's a data point. It just tells you, maybe you can compare one, I don't know, social media items engagement to another, and that might have some weight in an organization. But I could see how just, you know, there's challenges in organizations where people are just creating metrics for the sake of metrics, as opposed to driving towards an outcome with those.
When the trade-off for those metrics are things like respect for your customers, privacy, like compliance, you know, it's kind of like the things that we are sacrificing in the name of these metrics has always baffled me.
Yeah, same. So what inspired you then to leave big tech and start Discernible? There's definitely a lot of issues that I'm sure you had your hands on at these companies. So yeah, why'd you decide to go out on your own?
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hello, loyal listeners. The Shifting Privacy Left podcast is seeking sponsors who want to help educate our growing community of privacy engineers. Position your brand in front of privacy engineers, architects, developers, researchers, and privacy tech buyers. Insert a 30 to 60 second ad like this one into every published episode of the podcast. This is dynamic content, after all. Feature your new product, an upcoming conference, a sponsored special deal, endless opportunities. Email sponsorship@shiftingprivacyleft.com for more information on our sponsorship package. Okay, let's get back to our engaging privacy conversation.
Yeah, so, I mean, truthfully, I knew very soon after I joined Facebook, I knew I was going to go out on my own eventually. I just needed to figure out what was my business model, you know, what were we actually going to sell as a company, where was our focus going to be, what would be our methodology. And truthfully, part of the reason why I chose the job at Uber is because Uber had never had security or privacy communications before. And so it was an opportunity to build that program from scratch using my methodology and essentially creating kind of like a proof of concept, right? And I'm really proud of the things that we accomplished at Uber while I was there, considering the reputation the company had previously. And all of those things were very genuine. In fact, I remember one of the earliest projects that I worked on was the differential privacy efforts that the privacy engineering team did with the interns at Berkeley. I think there was actually something you talked about with Minotti during his episode.
Yes, I was just going to say, we dove into that.
Yeah, and when we were getting ready to open source projects, we wanted to make sure that people knew about it because, you know, open source projects get better when more people use them and contribute to them. So we set up an interview with a reporter to kind of give them the exclusive on the story. And I nearly like peed my pants laughing, honestly, when this reporter asked, is this something that you built just for PR? And like, I nearly fell out of my seat where I was like, I wish I had a team of engineers just building things for me. When I was there, like, we weren't building things just for PR, right? Like, there weren't resources to do that. And also, that doesn't make any sense, right? The amount of time and engineering effort that goes into building something like a differential privacy platform to do all of that for like one or two news articles, like, makes zero sense, right?
Right.
But I laughed at the question silently because I'm like, if I had Minotti's team building things for me, number one, this is not what I would have asked for. But number two, I was baffled. I was like, are there companies that actually build stuff like this just for some press coverage? Like it floored me. But having worked with so many people in big tech who then went off to become CISOs and engineering directors, they kind of, you know, the alumni network of these companies is pretty significant and very impressive. They were all asking me while I was at Uber, when are you going to go start your own thing so that I can hire you to help me with what I'm doing now? Because they had, you know, we had worked together for years at other companies. And, you know, when you build that kind of network of folks who understand the value that you bring, who don't understand why their new company hasn't provided it to them yet, and they know that there's somebody who could help them if only she were available, that was a very compelling argument for me to go, okay, maybe now is the time that I should do this. And we launched the company on a Monday. And by the end of the week, we had our first client. So, you know, I have to credit, you know, the really amazing people that I've been very lucky to work with over the years as kind of being the catalyst that finally helped me get past all of my hesitation to go, okay, there's a pipeline of companies already lined up who need this help. And, you know, we've kind of been running full speed ever since.
That's just, it's awesome. I've been watching, you know, the growth of Discernible, and it's just, it delights me to see your successes. And there's so many things that obviously, like, I'm in awe of a lot of what you've accomplished and a lot of who you are. But one of the things that really strikes me is how much you put a focus on ethics in your work. It's not just something you say. It's really like rules you live by. And in preparing for this interview and looking at your, you know, blog posts and websites, I see that you really focus on the Arthur W. Page Society principles, kind of almost a code of ethics in the comms world. And I had not previously been aware of it. So do you mind just kind of running through kind of the foundation of the Page principles and, you know, how you navigate ethics in your work?
Sure. I mean, truth be told, the reason these principles are on our website, number one, is for accountability and transparency. I think people deserve to know who they are reaching out to before they reach out for help from my team. But it's also been an incredible filter for us of being really clear that this is how we operate. So if you want something outside of this, we're not going to be a good fit. We are very, I think, privileged to be in a position where we can say no to business. And, you know, more often than not, if it's not a bandwidth concern, it is often a misalignment in values. So having these on the website makes it very clear, not just how we work, but who we're willing to work with as well. And Arthur W. Page Society, so they're very well known in the world of corporate communicators. Like I mentioned, you know, I got my master's of science in this field. And so I've been aware of kind of these like various groups and industry associations for a long time. And there are a number of them, but Arthur W. Page always really stood out to me because it was created by like chief communication officers, if you can imagine that those actually exist. And they do at some of like the world's largest companies. And they're responsible for a lot more than just PR and media and content. Like they are, you know, they're stewards of the corporate personality, persona, and kind of like all of the external affairs of the company. And so this was the level of professionalism that I always aspired to as I was growing up in my career. So these are the principles that we chose to use at Discernible.
Do you want to read them out?
Sure. So they are: tell the truth, prove it with action, listen to stakeholders, manage for tomorrow, conduct public relations as if the whole enterprise depends on it, realize an enterprise's true character is expressed by its people, and remain calm, patient, and good-humored.
I love the seventh one. I think that's great, especially the good-humored part.
I mean, we deal with a lot of sensitive topics, which you can imagine, in security and privacy, but like at the end of the day, it's also really important that we focus on the humans that are affected by what we do, the humans who are involved in what we do, like our own team and our clients. Like one of the biggest benefits that I've gotten from starting my own company is just having a fucking life. I never really had a life before. I am a better person because I spend less time working, to be honest. I am a better partner. I'm a better friend. I'm even a better advisor to my client because I have experience in the world outside of my job. And so, you know, I think it's really important that we take our work seriously, but we don't take ourselves too seriously.
I think that's great advice. So earlier we were talking about PR and some tensions between PR and necessarily, you know, maybe they don't understand necessarily the internal comms or driving stories that PR is going to pick up in the media or that the media is going to pick up. Sorry. So what makes for a good story that the media would want to cover? And I'm asking this question. I know your answer. I'm asking this for the audience because I think your answer is going to be pretty enlightening about what works and what doesn't work in trying to communicate for public relations purposes.
Yeah. So the key thing, I mean, the number one thing is, why does it matter? Like being able to very clearly and concisely explain why something matters can be a difficult task, especially when it's something that you care so much about and something that you are so close to, right?
Does my new feature that I just shipped matter?
Well, it depends on who you are and what your feature does.
Yeah.
And I think that's the thing particularly, I mean, we work with a lot of startups, both in security and privacy. And I think that one of the early conversations that we have with folks, especially those where, you know, if the founders are coming from big tech companies, they're used to getting press coverage for sneezing. If you are at a startup that nobody has ever heard of yet, you kind of have to earn your stripes. It is a longer road to get the kind of coverage that you are used to if you are working at, say, Microsoft or Facebook or IBM. Like these companies get lots of press coverage, not just because of how big they are and how influential they are, but because, or maybe I should say as a result of those things, there are reporters at all of the major news outlets who are responsible for writing stories just about that company. Right. So, you know, there is somebody at the New York Times and somebody at the Wall Street Journal whose entire job is writing about Amazon. Right. So they're going to write a lot of things about Amazon with varying degrees of importance because they need to file a story about Amazon that day. Right. If you are not that big brand, we have different expectations in terms of how we get attention from media and whether or not we should get attention from media and specifically which media in that mix do we want to be engaging with. And a lot of times, I mean, I don't know many PR people would say this, and I guess maybe I consider myself a former PR person who has graduated into more strategic comms, but you don't have to filter your message through the media. You know, media relations is a means to an end. It is not the goal in and of itself. Coverage for the sake of coverage is not a thing, at least not a worthwhile thing. Like I am the CEO of a communications company and I have spent $0 on media relations. So I think it's important to note that there are ways to get your message out to the people who need to hear it without going through the lens of a reporter and hoping that they understand the essence of what you're talking about and the meaning of what you're doing. I have seen really successful tech startups in both security and privacy, you know, who have started by reaching out directly to the community, right? I mean, you and I are both involved in Entroped, which is the rise of privacy tech. That is a great way for privacy tech companies to immediately get in front of their target buyers, you know, no media filter required. And so thinking about what are your business goals? What objectives do you have? And being savvy enough to understand that you may not actually have to engage with the media proactively in order to get to where you want to go. Now, you mentioned Elon previously, so there's definitely some strategic differences in the way he and I would approach reactive media in terms of responding to questions from the press. But, you know, you don't have to be, you know, pitching your company to media every day to get the business objectives that you need, especially in this world of all of these different communication channels where we can create our own content and go directly to the people that we're trying to talk to.
Makes a lot of sense to me. So we talked kind of, you know, I brought up bringing like a product, service, or feature to market. And like, you know, I also know that you don't think press releases are that impactful in these days anymore. So what does work? And maybe I should ask you first, what works well if not press releases And I don't know, like, how do you get her?
Sure.
Right. If you're going to market with something. But then I also wanted to ask you about how you can get maybe an internal project that was really cool. Like you were talking earlier about the differential privacy, you know, bringing it from the lab to the real world and one of the first real world deployments at Uber. How would you bring that story to light and become more public? Like, if you could kind of walk us through your thought process there.
Sure. So I do need to note, I have one exception to my press releases aren't worth it rule.
Okay.
Which is funding announcements. And the reason I say that is because even though nobody who's buying security or privacy is reading press releases, investors are. The investment community reads press releases. So if you are announcing a Series A, having a press release about that is helpful in your, you know, when you start trying to raise for Series B, for example. And I have done lots of press releases for startups who are announcing the close of a funding round. So that is one exception that I do think is valuable. But it is certainly not valuable in securing press coverage. A press release in and of itself is not going to get you, you know, tons of press attention. But again, going back to what I said previously, it doesn't have to. You might not need that right now, right? And there are other ways to get it. And, you know, so when we're thinking about launching a product or a new feature or even an internal project like the differential privacy project at Uber, for me, the big thing was why does this matter? It was never about this matters because Uber is doing it. The brand behind the story is rarely the most important part of the story. This mattered because it was going to be an open source tool for something that a lot of companies were struggling to do, right? So many companies had tried to build this internally, and here was a way for them to kind of leapfrog a couple of steps, right? That this was going to be an accelerated way for them to be able to integrate this technology into what they were building. So first and foremost, that was a really compelling story, specifically for a technical audience, right? This is not a story that, you know, consumers are going to care about necessarily. So that we leaned into that aspect of the story when we were talking to reporters who write for other engineers, right? That this is now a resource that's available to you. And, you know, what was the process in building it? And then for the mainstream reporters, it was an opportunity for us to actually educate people on what differential privacy actually is and what it does, right? There's always confusion, you know, when there's a new technology coming out. And I know that you have seen this, particularly when your work, you know, have been talking about privacy enhancing technologies and nobody really understands what everything means and there's different definitions for things. So we knew that if this was going to be something that was important to the company and to the community moving forward, we needed to be part of the education process, right? So in those conversations with mainstream media, we were talking about why does this matter to consumers, right? And it matters to consumers because it kind of erases a lot of the excuses that big tech had been using for decades about, you know, why they couldn't do certain things in a more privacy preserving way, right? Because here's proof that it can be done.
Right.
Which is also a really important message for regulatory and policy stakeholders, right? So, you know, we were never pushing a story for the sake of pushing a story. I think that's what, you know, Nishan is talking about when he said, like, to me, it was never really, you know, pushing out, like, getting an article was never the goal for me. It was, who do I need to have this conversation with, right? And if I don't already have a relationship with them, how can I get their attention? And how can I get that dialogue started? Because most people that I know are too busy to read a full-length article, even from the best reporters. So if I can build that relationship without having to do hours and hours of press interviews, I'm going to take that accelerated path. And for some audiences, I know that being vulnerable in front of a reporter is the only way that that message is going to be credible if it's coming from particular brands, let's say. You know, the differential, when the story I told about this reporter who asked about the differential privacy project at Uber, I mean, even though I thought the question was funny, because I was like, oh God, I wish I had engineers at my beck and call. Yeah. The reality was, is it was a valid question, right? To that point, the company did not have a great reputation for respecting user data or caring about privacy. I mean, the reality is that Minoti and his team had existed for years, but it does take a long time to build these systems. And there isn't a story to tell until the project is real, right?
Right.
And so, like I said, I understood where the question came from. And I understood that Uber at that time was not the most credible messenger for this message. And so working with media was a way to earn some of that credibility. I mean, this reporter that asked us this question is very sharp, very technical, and knows their stuff. So if this reporter was convinced that we were genuine, that meant something to the rest of the community. And so it's about being strategic with who you're talking to about what, why, and when. And it's not just blasting emails to reporters every time you write a new line of code.
Right, right. Now, I know we have just a very little amount of time left, and I do want to get your perspective maybe on a few comms snafus that have been in the headlines recently. And so the first would be around Twitter. And let's say as Musk took over Twitter, he pretty much laid off all the comms team.
Yeah, like he did at Tesla previously.
Right, right. So this is something that he's, you know, he doesn't seem to put a value as much on comms as others might. So I'd like to just get at, you know, what would you have done differently, or what are some of the problems that have arisen from a lack of comms at Twitter during this time?
I mean, I think the biggest problem for Twitter not having a comms team is that everybody can see Elon for exactly who he is. I think a lot of corporate comms teams, one of the biggest values that they can provide to their company, and you know, this is for better or worse, is that they can shield executives from their worst qualities, right? That they kind of save them from themselves in terms of how they represent the company. And I think the fact that Elon does not value the guidance and advice of a professional communications advisor, I think speaks to the larger issue of people that have so much power that they truly don't have to care what other people think.
Yeah. Yeah. And I wish we had more time to delve into that one, but I then want to go next to... Yeah.
Elon is my least favorite That's topic fair. To talk about.
That's fair. Well, I'm glad I made it brief then. The other would be, you know, OpenAI's ChatGPT and the fact that personal data across the web was used to train these models, even though it's amazing technology. So there's this kind of dichotomy of, holy crap, this technology could be really helpful and look at all the things it can do or potential for it. And then on the other side is, what does that mean for personal data that's been siphoned from people without their consent or any sort of remuneration? So when it came to Mark, I mean, it's all anyone's talking about these days is large language models, chatbots, you know, AI, its potential. So, you know, I guess with OpenAI, what would you have advised them to do differently in terms of comms?
It's a tough question because truthfully, I have not spent a lot of time thinking about it.
Well, that's fair.
But in terms of like specifically what that organization should have done differently.
Yeah, so they kind of came to market and was like, here's our next iteration of ChatGPT. Everyone can use it.
Yeah, I mean, it's like I saw what they did, but I haven't thought a lot about like what were the alternatives. I rolled my eyes and moved on to the next dumpster fire. Again, I think it speaks to your values, right? I don't think that they did this not knowing that that was a possibility. I think they either miscalculated the likelihood that people would care, or they very clearly calculated how little they cared.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of a little unclear, right? They went from being called OpenAI, but now they're offering this closed, you know, not open product.
And I think the closed is more about protecting IP. Otherwise, no enterprise is going to sign a license. I think it's more about that than protecting personal data. I mean, has yet to convince me that privacy is a priority.
Well, either way, they were going to be a nonprofit, and now they've got this for-profit arm that, you know, Microsoft has invested billions into. So that doesn't look very great. Earn trust.
I mean, truthfully, I think their launch was a publicity stunt, and I think they got exactly what they wanted from it. So
now everyone's talking about it.
You know, what was an effective strategy? Yeah. Does it reflect who they are as people and what they value? Yeah.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, so they've since come out with more information on ways that they're protecting privacy and ways that they're implementing data protection rights to satisfy different EU regulators. But basically, because they had a lack of comm strategy, you know, going to market, they've now got all this, you know, these regulatory headwinds, especially out of Europe, but, you know, that are probably thorns in their side right now. So there probably were better ways to come to market where they wouldn't have those headwinds. If they had had more discussions, if they had more, I don't know, expertise on their team, a whole bunch of things.
And honestly, I think this speaks to kind of one of the biggest challenges that we're having in general in the privacy industry, is that it is a challenge to convince many organizations that avoiding these headwinds is worth it. Because many of them got to where they were by thwarting regulations and simply paying whatever it cost for their outside counsel to deal with all the lawsuits and investigations and audits and all of that, right? So it very quickly became the cost of doing business rather than a motivator to consider alternatives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do think that I think we see that often in the Silicon Valley.
And truthfully, a lot of it is like a forced error on our part as a community and privacy profession, where the more we talk about what we do as compliance, the less interesting it is for anybody else to listen to us.
100%. Even when I did pure compliance, in a role, I never referred to it as compliance. You know, it's my own comms there.
Yeah. I mean, even if I'm selling a solution that helps with compliance, nobody wants to spend money on something that just makes them look adequate at their job.
Yeah, totally.
I need your compliance solution to make it easier for me to win resources, to create allies inside my company, to make my business partners happy, and to elevate the position of my organization from compliance to a business advisor. If all you are offering me is something that checks the box, then I have to do all of the heavy lifting of explaining and connecting the dots between compliance to business results. Like, that should be built into your product.
Absolutely.
Otherwise, why would I buy it? I don't want to look mediocre at my job. I want to be so awesome that nobody ever refers to my program as compliance.
I agree. I mean, obviously, like, I care a lot about, you know, shifting left, right? So I really do agree. I think compliance is important, but it is not sufficient for a privacy program, security program.
Well, I can recognize as an individual that compliance is like my personal values align with complying with legal requirements for the most part. There are plenty of laws around the world that are incredibly unjust, and some civil disobedience can be warranted from time to time. But I can recognize, like I said, as an individual professional, that actually being compliant with the laws is important. But that's not how I sell what I do to the business. Because
it's not important enough to them.
Exactly. Right. Because, I mean, you point out any company within the Fortune 500 that hasn't broken a law in pursuit of business success. I pay more taxes than Amazon, okay?
Right.
So, you know, it's like the law in and of itself is not a motivator for people who have not spent the last two decades of their life learning it.
No, it's absolutely true. Right. So it's
especially when laws can change, right? Laws are not a moral code.
That's true. It's more of a framework so that as they change, you want to be able to handle those changes and be able to communicate that into the business So you want to have those feedback loops within the business to be able to communicate about new changes in the regulatory environment.
Here's the thing. When you sit down with it, you know, with any big tech CEO, and they ask what the risks are of not complying with something, they're not asking because they're going to lose sleep over it. They're asking because they want to know how much it costs and whether or not they can afford the legal risk of not doing it.
Exactly.
If they can, they're probably not going to do it.
Oh, exactly. This is, I mean, it's also another reason why I think self-regulatory doesn't work. You need actual external regulators.
These people did not get to where they are through the generosity of their heart.
Indeed. It's a really great point. So before we close, because I feel like we could talk for hours, are there any resources that you would like to recommend where privacy technologists can learn more about effective communications? I mean, please also tell them about your newsletter and, you know, but anywhere else as well.
Sure. So, I mean, our newsletter, of course, we include everything from, you know, contemporary communication research to theory, because again, like the scholarship of communication is so valuable in, you know, forming strategy and execution, right? There's no reason why any communication effort needs, like, we don't need to be guessing, right? We have enough knowledge and research that we can make informed decisions about this. So that's certainly a resource.
You include psychology in it, studies about the brain and neurology, comparisons to sharks and marine biology. I mean, it's just, it's really great, unique.
Yeah, it's a lot more than how do you write the TLDR at the top of an email.
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah. But I also, you know, to share some resources that aren't about myself, GitHub has a newsletter called README, which is one of my favorite things to read these days, because this content is curated by a professional editorial team. They've got former editors from Wired and other publications, and 99% of the content is contributed by external engineers, right, that are working on open source projects. But because they have the opportunity to work with amazing content experts and editors, the articles are all really good. And it's making engineers more effective in the way that they write and in the way that they communicate with their teams. So if you're not already subscribed to the GitHub README newsletter, I highly recommend it. It's some of the best writing from technical experts without having to read a full-length research paper.
Oh, that's awesome. I was not aware of that resource, so I'm going to check that out and subscribe. Thank you. Awesome. Any other parting words or, you know, tips for our listeners about comms?
You know, if you care, you're half of the way there. You know, thinking about effective communication starts with thinking about your audience and what your goals and objectives are. So, I mean, you may not have noticed as we've been going through this conversation, but I have been very deliberate in what I have said this entire time, because I'm thinking about who could be listening, what is it they need to know, where are they in their journey, and how can I be most helpful for them in terms of thinking differently about the way that they communicate both as individuals and as an organization. So there really is no such thing as a non-strategic conversation, just conversations where you're not paying attention to the strategy that's happening.
That is really fascinating and a great place to end. Melanie, thank you so much for joining us today on the Shifting Privacy Left podcast. I really enjoyed talking about comms with you. I'm sure I'll have you back on the show in the future. And thanks for coming today.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me. And for folks who are interested, you can find me on Mastodon. I'm Wednesday at defcon.social, and you can find me on LinkedIn as well. I'm not on Twitter.
I'm not on Twitter anymore. Yeah, it's sad. Well, thanks for joining us today, everyone. Until next Tuesday, when we'll be back with engaging content and another great guest.
Thanks for joining us this week on Shifting Privacy Left. Make sure to visit our website, shiftingprivacyleft.com, where you can subscribe to updates so you'll never miss a show. While you're at it, if you found this episode valuable, go ahead and share it with a friend. And if you're an engineer who cares passionately about privacy, check out Privado, the developer-friendly privacy platform and sponsor of this show. To learn more, go to privado.ai. Be sure to tune in next Tuesday for a new episode. Bye for now.